Today I'm going to be speaking about some recent work that I've done with Douglas Finkbeiner and Nicole Padmanabhan on using the CMB to constrain dark matter annihilation during the epoch of recombination. The title is actually a little misleading, although there are some interesting constraints on some of Feldenkrais' dark matter. It's not restricted to those models. So I'll first describe just how dark matter during the epoch of recombination Just how dark matter annihilation during the epoch of recombination influences the CMB by hitting an ionization of the IgM. IgM intergalactic medium is a bit of an anachronism at redshift 1000, but it's a convenient one. I'll then talk about the new work that we've done, which we calculated in detail the fraction of the energy from dark matter annihilation that is absorbed into the gas and influences the CMB. This allows us to use the WMAP data to put limits on the amount of energy that can be injected by dark matter annihilation, and hence on the dark matter models which have been proposed to explain the cosmic ray excesses that we've heard so much about today. So we find that those models are rather close to the WMAP-5 95% confidence limits in all cases, and the recently launched Planck satellite should be able to test all of these models in a fairly model-independent way. First question is, why would we look at the epoch of recombination for useful constraints on dark matter annihilation? Unlike many of the other indirect detection methods that we've heard about, the physics during the epoch of recombination is fairly free of uncertainties in galactic astrophysics, like uncertainties in the propagation parameters and the dark matter density profile. It is not as sensitive to the spectrum of annihilation products as, for example, the cosmic ray measurements from Fermilab and Attic and Fermi. It depends mostly on the total power injected, which means that it can be a fairly model-independent way to constrain dark matter annihilation. It's also especially sensitive to models with boosted annihilation at low velocities, since during the epoch of recombination, the dark matter is very slow-moving, which is especially relevant for models with Sommerfeld enhancement that have been proposed to explain the cosmic ray excesses. So the actual mechanism by which dark matter annihilation and recombination affect the CMB. So WMP annihilation injects high energy particles, electrons, neutrinos, photons, and protons. It may, of course, immediately annihilate other particles, but if they're unstable, they will decay to showers of stable particles. The energy injected in neutrinos and protons at the ends of this cascade largely escapes and doesn't affect the IgM. Neutrinos, because they interact so weakly, protons, because they're very penetrating and deposit their energy only poorly. However, electrons and photons can ionize the hydrogen and modify the surface of blast scattering. At the energies at which they're injected by dark matter annihilation, the electrons and photons are very inefficient at ionizing hydrogen. So they need to cool first, down to below about an MeV for electrons or below a KeV for photons. It becomes a question of how much of the energy of annihilation goes into ionizing and heating the gas, as opposed to just being redshifted away or going into photons, which free stream to the present day. However, the energy that does go into ionizing the hydrogen, the effect of that is to leave a greater than normal residual ionization fraction after recombination. It has the effect of broadening the surface of blast scattering. These plots show, as a function of redshift, the ionization fraction and the visibility function for a number of different energy injections from dark matter annihilation. The highest lines are a rather extreme case. This is for a 1,000. This is for a 1 TeV particle, and just for the purpose of illustration, annihilating to a 4-electron final state with boost factors from some Feld enhancement or some other mechanism of 1, 10, 100, and 1,000. So don't take especially the higher models too seriously, but this is the general effect on the ionization fraction and the surface of blast scattering. This broadening of the blast scattering surface means that the temperature fluctuations in the CMB are suppressed, and polarization fluctuations also modify. This plot is taken from a paper by Galli et al., which came out about a month ago, and which shows the effect on the TT, EE, and TE CMB spectra for a range of energy injections from dark matter annihilation. So that's the general sort of effect that we're looking for. And it was first, and it's been investigated by a number of authors, including Finkbeiner and Padmanabhan earlier in 2005. And more recently, Galli et al. Updated it with BWMAP 5-year data. The new work that we've done, however, in all of these calculations were constraining an energy injection. The new work that we've done is to work out just how much of the energy from dark matter annihilation is absorbed for dark matter annihilation to a range of different channels and for a range of WIMP annihilation masses. To determine this, we have to look at how these weak scale electrons and photons lose their energy at redshift 1000, and how much of that energy goes into redshifting, and how much into feeding the IGM. The electron energy loss processes in order of the decreasing energy at which they're dominant are inverse Compton scattering, ionization and excitation of the gas, collisional heating, and for positrons, annihilation. Positrons behave very much like electrons at high energies, but once they have cooled and thermalized, they annihilate producing 511 kV gamma rays. All of these processes are quite fast compared to a Hubble time, and so redshifting is not a significant loss process. Because the inverse Compton scattering is so dominant at high energies, most of the energy injected in electrons is immediately converted to high energy gamma rays by inverse Compton scattering, although a small fraction of the energy goes into heating and ionizing the gas. But in the main, the problem comes down to understanding how these gamma rays lose their energy at redshift 1000. Because neutrinos and protons don't deposit their energy in electrons, the energy mostly immediately gets converted into a gamma ray spectrum. In order of decreasing energy, the important process is pair production on the CMB, downscattering on the CMB, pair production on the gas and on electrons, Compton scattering on electrons, and photoionization of the gas. Is there a laser pointer function on this? Or? Okay, it doesn't matter. Anyway. Or I could use the stick. I could use the stick.
Apologies for that.
So, yes, the processes I just mentioned. This plot shows the rate of the, shows the cooling time. This plot shows the Hubble time divided by the cooling time for the various photon energy loss processes as a function of energy at redshift 1000. What we see is that at very high energies, photon-photon scattering and pair production are extremely fast. Photons injected at those energies quickly scatter or pair produce. At very low energies, photoionization is very efficient, and the photons just promptly ionize the gas. However, there is this central region between about a keV and 100 GeV, so it's a broad region, where the dominant processes are only an order of magnitude or so faster than the Hubble time, and so redshifting needs to be taken into account, as well as these energy loss processes. That was at redshift 1000. At lower redshifts, the universe becomes more transparent just as the density drops. But in all cases, again, you have very fast photoionization at low energies, very fast pair production or photon-photon scattering at high energies, and this broad semi-transparent window in the center with this bump is just the effect of Compton scattering. So previous studies on this work have tended to just say that some fraction f of energy from Wimp annihilation is promptly deposited, heating and ionizing the IgM, and that the rest of the energy is redshifted away or appears in diffuse gamma backgrounds and never contributes to heating and ionization of the IgM. These studies have also tended to assume that f is independent of redshift. And within those approximations, you can put constraints on f times sigma v, the annihilation cross-section, divided by the mass of the dark matter. It's in the CMB. I'll show you those constraints later, but only once I've shown you how to calculate f so that we can actually put some points on the plot. So going beyond the on-the-spot approximation, which is what we've done in our latest work, is we've taken into account two additional factors, that WIMP annihilations at much earlier redshifts, at Z much greater than 2000, can still contribute to heating and ionizing the gas at redshift 1000 just because it can take a long time for these photons to cool down to the point where they can ionize hydrogen. The universe also becomes more transparent at later redshifts, as you've seen, which means that f of z, the efficiency of energy deposition, tends to drop off. So to describe these effects, we define the effective efficiency f of z just as if epsilon of z is the energy deposited to the IgM by dark matter annihilation per baryon per second at redshift z, then we have the energy injected by a single annihilation multiplied by the annihilation rate multiplied by the dark matter density squared divided by the baryon density. This 1 plus a cube scaling just occurring because we have two factors of density in the numerator and one in the denominator. And then the prefactor to this expression, the amount of energy that actually gets deposited to the gas and influences the CMB, is f of z. So we've calculated the energy absorption in detail numerically, just by numerically evolving the photon and electron spectra injected by dark matter annihilation through these various processes that I've described. The initial photon and electron spectrum are derived from Pythia. We did this calculation for a range of dark matter annihilation channels, so for annihilation to PET, so it's similar to the channels that Marco Cirelli discussed earlier, annihilations to pairs of gauge bosons, to BB bar, to quarks, to Higgs bosons, and so on. And our results, that plot actually worked out quite well. These plots show f of z for the various annihilation channels. What we've found is, as you might have expected from that earlier plot showing the photon losses, is that the energy that is injected as photons and electrons is actually quite efficiently absorbed eventually. Some of it is lost to redshifting, but the majority goes into heating or ionizing the gas. So these plots show f of z as a function of redshift z. This panel shows annihilation to two lepton final states, electrons, muons, and taus. The muon states are lower, obviously, because some of their energy escapes as neutrinos. This panel shows the equivalent calculation for annihilation to a range of standard model final states, to WZs, Higgs, BB bar, and light quarks. This panel shows it for annihilation through a new light state to electrons or muons, and this through some new light state of order of GeV to pions or taus. These later panels are motivated by models that have been suggested to explain the cosmic ray excesses. So there are a few things to note about these plots. One is that, as you might expect, f of z falls off at later redshifts. That's just a consequence of the universe becoming more transparent, and so the efficiency of energy deposition is lower. At high redshifts, they FZ asymptotes to approximately constant. This is also what you would expect when the energy is, when the universe is very dense, then all the electrons and photons are promptly absorbed and contribute to ionizational heating. It's also notable that in the region most relevant to modifying the surface of last scattering around redshifts 800 to 1000, FZ doesn't change very much and is fairly close to constant, which means that we can take these average values of FZ in that region of interest and directly apply them to the constraints that have been previously derived within the on-the-spot approximation. Of course, the ideal analysis would not do this and would instead work out the effect on the CMB and the likelihood analysis for the dark matter energy injection and the cosmological parameters based on these detailed F of Z functions. But just to see how close the models that we're interested in are to the constraint lines, this averaging procedure doesn't introduce an error of more than about 10% or so. So given that the fits to the cosmic ray models are uncertain at least the factor of two level just due to astrophysical uncertainties, this averaging procedure is reasonable just to see how good the constraints are. And this is just an expanded version of the panel for annihilation to electron final states. So this is the money plot. For this plot, we took several models that had been fitted to the recent cosmic ray excesses, and mostly from Hollis et al. And multiplied the annihilation cross-sections required to fit the cosmic ray excesses by the values of F that we had derived for the appropriate model and mass, and plotted them against the constraints given in Galli et al. On F times sigma V. This upper region, so the y-axis is F times sigma V, the x-axis is the dark matter mass in GeV. This upper region is ruled out by WMAP5 at the 95% confidence level. This intermediate region is the forecast reach for Planck, 95% confidence level. This last bar is the ultimate reach of a cosmic variance limited experiment with the same angular resolution as Planck. The square data points indicate models that fit Pamela only. The star data points indicate models that fit both Pamela and Attic. And the diamond points indicate models that fit both Pamela and Fermi. So to fit Fermi, you need a boost factor of order two or three lower than needed to fit Attic, just because their axis is about a third as big. So, of course, the annihilation cross-sections that you require to fit the cosmic ray excesses are somewhat uncertain because, as has been well explained this morning, the propagation parameters are somewhat uncertain, and the local dark matter density is also somewhat uncertain. The error bars on that plot are simply an indication of the change in boost factor if you presume that the local dark matter density is uncertain at the factor of two level. So that those are just factor of four error bars. So given those uncertainties, it's not possible to say that any of these models are ruled out by the CMB, but they are all rather close to the constraint line, and Planck should be able to test them in more detail. If Planck sees no evidence of modified recombination, then these models will need an astrophysical boost factor in the present day of order 10 or higher in order to match the cosmic ray data without violating the CMB. The models that are shown here are mostly annihilation to leptons or through a new light state to final states of four leptons. There are also a few models in here that have annihilation of charged pions and one that has annihilation of a Wino to Ws. As you can see, they're all very similar in where they are relative to CMB constraints. This is, as I said previously, just because the CMB is not very sensitive to the spectrum of electrons and photons produced. What it's mostly measuring At zeroth order, what it's mostly measuring is just the power injected in electrons and photons. And the cosmic ray experiments are, to zeroth order, just measuring the power injected in electrons. So if there's not a large branching ratio to photons, these two are very similar. So those are the constraints on general GM models. I'd now like to talk just briefly about the implications for models that involve a Sommerfeld enhancement. So this is the one slide review of the Sommerfeld enhancement. Sommerfeld enhancement is a non-perturbative boost to annihilation at low velocities. It's caused when you have a new light state which mediates an interact, well, not necessarily new, when you have a particle much lighter than the dark matter which mediates an interaction between the dark matter particles. This attractive interaction causes a non-perturbative enhancement to the annihilation cross-section at low velocities. So if you have 10 TeV dark matter, then you can use standard model gauge bosons to mediate this enhancement. My collaborators and I, in the paper that Maxime mentioned, suggested that new light particles around the GeV scale could mediate a Sommerfeld enhancement for weak scale dark matter, and other authors have also worked on models like that. The advantage of these models is that it means that you can have a large annihilation cross-section in the present-day galactic halo relative to the cross-section at dark matter freeze-out. So a thermal relic WIMP can still have cross-sections large enough to explain the observed cosmic ray excesses. The important qualities of the Sommerfeld enhancement for this calculation is that as the Sommerfeld enhancement scales as alpha divided by V, where V is the relative velocity of the WIMPs, alpha is the controls the coupling between the WIMPs and the dark matter, until some saturation point determined by the mass of the particle mediating the interaction. This is just for the simplest Yukawa potential. The point at which the enhancement saturates is where V divided by C is approximately equal to the mass of the mediator divided by the mass of the dark matter. The dark matter velocity at redshift 1000 is very small. It's been estimated by Galli et al. To be of order 10 to the minus 8 times C for 100 GeV WIMP. This is just because the dark matter is not gravitationally bound as yet. We compare this to the oversea of 10 to the minus 4 or 10 to the minus 3 in the present-day galactic halo in the neighborhood of the Earth, then it's clear that in any Sommerfeld enhanced model, if the enhancement is not to be, either the enhancement will be much, much greater than it is in the present day, a redshift 1000, or it will already have saturated. But we have just shown that if you want to fit the observed cosmic ray excesses with the Sommerfeld enhanced model, which was the motivation for many of these models, then the maximum saturated cross-section allowed by the CMB is similar to the present-day cross-section. Consequently, if Sommerfeld enhanced models are to fit the cosmic ray excesses, then they must be saturated, or nearly so, in the present-day galactic halo at V of C of 10 to the minus 4 to 10 to the minus 3. And this is just a consistency check. We did assume throughout our calculation that the cross-section was independent of redshift, but the only case in which that sigma V is independent of redshift, but which is not true in a Sommerfeld-enhanced model that isn't saturated. But as we've just demonstrated, if the Sommerfeld enhancement was not saturated in the regime in question, the CMB constraints would be violated by four orders of magnitude. So it's justifiable to assume a constant sigma V. So in particular, if we're in the simplest case where the Sommerfeld enhancement is mediated by some scalar, which generates an attractive Yukawa potential, this places a lower bound on the mass of the force carrier. for example, that the mass of the force carrier divided by the mass of the dark matter cannot be much smaller than 10 to the minus 4. This means, for example, that for a 1 TeV WIMP, models with 100 MeV mediators are probably borderline, and 10 MeV mediators are likely to be ruled out, even taking into account the astrophysical uncertainties. This is quite relevant for some collider searches that have been suggested recently, where people were interested in looking for these potential new light states and the tens of MeV level. This was the analysis for the case of non-resonant enhancement. In resonant enhancement, the saturation is delayed to lower velocity, so that actually makes the limits on MV stronger. It's possible, and yes, it's possible that that in models which require the enhancement to be very close to a resonance in order to satisfy the cosmic ray excesses, then these results could place considerably stronger constraints on the mass of the mediator.
Well, the scale of the wheel is probably disfavored anyways, because
sure.
They would go to phi naught or gamma would very well.
Sure. This is certainly true. However, it's been generally said that the Sommerfeld enhancement in more complicated cases is similar to the simplest Yukawa case. If that's not true, then light force carriers could still be allowed. That's actually something that we're hoping to investigate in the future, just how the Sommerfeld enhancement changes if you allow multiple force carriers, if you allow mass splittings between the states. Going okay for time. See, I thought this was a 35-minute, the talk last questions. It got changed to 40 minutes last minute. So that's actually most of what I want to talk about. I just wanted to add this note at the end, and that is that dark matter annihilation during the epoch of recombination can also modify the apparent cosmological parameters. Or to put it another way, those changes to the TT, TE, and EE powers, the TT, TE, and EE spectra that I showed earlier can be largely compensated by changing a few of the cosmological parameters so that it's difficult to disentangle the effect of dark matter annihilation from the effect of different values of the cosmological parameters. You can estimate this effect semi-analytically. This is an effect on the temperature, anisotropy, angular power spectrum. By separating the temperature, anisotropy, power spectrum into a term from the gravitational potentials and a term from silt damping, the increase in the width of the fluctuations with scales less than the width of the last scattering surface are damped. So increasing the width of the last scattering surface increases the damping. We find, just by numerical fitting, that the effect of dark matter annihilation on this damping function is very well fitted by multiplying it by a power law, Damp's k to the alpha. So if we insert that into this expression, then we can see that the effect of dark matter annihilation on the temperature anisotropy spectrum can be quite well compensated by modifying the amplitude and the value of n sub s, the primordial scalar spectral index. So these plots show the upper plot is taken from Gallier et al. And shows the effect on n sub s if they allow the power injection from DM annihilation as an extra parameter in their likelihood analysis for the cosmological parameters from the WMAP data. And it gets shifted upward, because the effects of dark matter annihilation can be nearly exactly compensated by increasing n sub s. So in the presence of dark matter annihilation, n sub s and sigma 8 appear smaller than their true values. So the true value is higher, of order 0.98 in this fit, than it looks in the WMAP data without taking dark matter annihilation into account, so 0.965. This plot just shows for a range of models how much they perturb n sub s. But of course, at these larger perturbations to N sub s are ruled out. This is just the effect on the temperature and isotropy spectrum. The polarization spectra allow you to break this degeneracy. But at present, at least, at present, there is still room for dark matter annihilation to modify N sub s by a non-negligible amount. So the future directions, I think I have mentioned most of this at this point. We'd like to do the actual detailed likelihood analysis using our accurate expressions for f of z, not just averaging over the region in question. As further cosmic ray data come in, we'll continue to update these constraints. And as further models of dark matter continue to be suggested to explain them, we'll continue to update the points on that constraints plot. We would like to explore some of Feldenhant's models other than the simple Yukawa potential scenario to see if light force carriers might still be allowed in a case more complicated than a single scalar mediating the enhancement. It would also be fairly straightforward to expand our detailed energy absorption calculation to decaying dark matter. We haven't done that yet, but that might also place interesting constraints on decaying dark matter. So the conclusions of this work are that we've performed the first detailed calculation of the energy absorption efficiency in the epoch of recombination for WIMP annihilation, which allows us to directly compare the dark matter models that have been proposed to explain the cosmic ray excesses to the CMB constraints. We've found that the cross-sections and annihilation channels which fit the cosmic ray anomalies lie very close to the WMAP 5 95% limits, although since those fits have large astrophysical uncertainties, it is not possible to rule out any of the suggested models at this point. A broad range of dark matter explanations for the cosmic ray excesses should be able to be excluded by Planck at the 95% confidence limit unless the local astrophysical boost factor is greater than a factor of 10, or unless there is some other contribution to the cosmic ray excesses. And for some of Feldenhant's models which fit the cosmic ray data, the enhancement is close to saturated in the neighborhood of the Earth, which in the simplest Yukawa potential case means that force carriers with masses much less than 10 to the minus 4 times the dark matter mass are disfavored. And this is tentative and qualitative, but dark matter annihilation may also mean that the true values of N sub s and also sigma 8 are higher than previously thought from the CMB. So thank you for listening. Thank you very much for inviting me. And we have 10 minutes for questions.
Yeah. So you've concentrated on the last step from surface because you're interested in setting limits from the CMB anisotropies. What about a release of energy that takes place before, in fact, the epoch of recombination? And is there any limit on the chemical potential of the cosmic microwave background and spectral distortions in the same lines of
We looked briefly at that, and just from a back of the envelope calculation, it looked like the limits were not going to be interesting.
With limiting the dramatic decay, you mean that maybe you can obtain some bound relevant for dark matter decay interpretations of Kamala?
We haven't really looked in any detail at dark matter decay. There have been some previous studies on the effects of dark matter decay and annihilation on the CMB, like Chen and Kamiankowski in 2004. So I'm sorry, I can't say yet whether the constraints for models explaining Fermilab would be where the models explaining Fermilab would be anywhere close to the constraint.
So usually better than lifetimes.
Yes. So it might just not be relevant at all. But even if they don't explain, I was more thinking about just going back to previous calculations of constraints on decaying dark matter and doing them more rigorously, since we now have the framework set up to calculate that energy absorption exactly.
I have a question, so I don't think it's very important, but with this
you keep the wire states at certain sites, you also have some antiproteins in the final states, right? And those probably propagate long time before the analyte, so they deposit energy much later.
So that could be important. Generally, protons and antiprotons are just, they're very bad at depositing their, they're very bad at depositing their energy to CMB. They just go on forever. But eventually, the antiprotons will annihilate. Eventually, will dump their energy. It's just. It's just going to be a small fraction of the wind mass. We didn't really look into the protons and antiprotons just because the energy from electrons and photon losses is so dominant. And even for models where you make antiprotons and physics when you do cosmic ray excesses, we're most interested in models that don't make antiprotons in any case. Yes?
So your f of s depends on the decay channel, right?
Yes.
So when you derive your constraints, do you have to assume some branching relation in different channels, or you just
So these constraint plots, when I said these points are for specific models, so specific branching ratios, so specific annihilation channels plus masses plus annihilation cross sections that fit the cosmic ray excesses. I mean, it's certainly true that F of Z depends on the annihilation channel, but to a large degree, what it depends on is how much of the energy eventually goes into electrons and photons, as opposed to neutrinos or protons or antiprotons. And the cosmic ray excesses are also measuring how much of the energy goes into electrons. So that I think is why all the points that explain a particular experiment are similarly close to the constraint line. There's that degeneracy that you need. If 70% of the energy goes into the neutrinos, then it won't keep the CMB, but it also won't show up in the map.
But like, so on the y-axis, you have an f there, right? Oh. What's that f? Is it like a variable as a function?
So the f there is the... the f there in the original calculation by Galli et al. Was they were assuming just a constant f, which they left as a free parameter. In our calculation, it's just the average value of f of z for that channel, averaged over redshift 800 to 1,000.
Very well. If there are no more questions, let's thank our speaker.